This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision-making for Canadians. We are hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore. Welcome to the 15th episode of the Rational Reminder Podcast. This is a special episode that we're recording from Chicago. And we're joined by PWL Capital's president, Brenda Bartlett. Thanks for joining us, Brenda.
Thank you.
Bringing the show on the road.
Yeah. The idea of today is that we spent all day yesterday and last night with people from Dimensional Fund Advisors. We're at their advanced conference, as many of our listeners know. And we thought it would be kind of cool to talk about some of the things that we learned yesterday while it's top of mind. Because there are, I'm sure, lots of little details that we might forget as time goes on.
And it's a good link to what Martin was saying last week in the podcast, talking about how what has come out of academia changed his mind, you know, as a guy that came from the active world and realized that there's a whole lot of merit in what's going on in academia. So it's a good bridge.
Yeah, it is. And there were quite a few talks that we attended yesterday. There were really three, I guess, that spoke to me. So we'll try and talk about a couple of those as much as we can, but we got a history of the University of Chicago and how that ties in with Dimensional Fund Advisors, which was really interesting. And then
incredible school, incredible history.
Yeah, the story's crazy. Probably the highlight of the day. Well, I think the highlight of the day for everybody was probably hearing Eugene Fama, who's obviously a Nobel laureate and the father of modern finance. He was here in person and spoke to the room in like a casual chat format. Like it was cool.
Well, he had the Nobel laureate swagger, so no matter what he says, everyone was impressed.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he had swagger. Every time he gets a question, he laughs before he answers it. It's like a swagger laugh. Like, this question again.
And he works every single day of the year.
And he's almost 80?
79,
like, yeah. So he's a pretty impressive guy.
But you think about that. He's been studying capital markets since 1960. He arrived here for his PhD.
Mm-hmm. Every day.
Every single day.
So I do have some notes from the talk that I think it's kind of interesting to walk through. But the University of Chicago was started by John D. Rockefeller. And he started it with the stated intention of connecting economics with academia. So he saw an opportunity to study economics and actually apply that to the real economy to improve the country.
Yep, apply research to real world problems.
Yeah.
And the first guy that they talked about was Milton Friedman, who I studied in economics.
Everybody did.
Yeah.
That's the crazy, like you start listing off these names, Friedman, Samuelson, Harry Markowitz, Merton Miller, it's like the people who founded economics and finance.
Myron Scholes,
Fisher Black. Yeah.
So all these people came through the University of Chicago. And like you said, Brenda, you can't sit through a finance or economics course and not hear about these people.
That's right.
Like I think some of their
textbooks. They're the icons.
Yeah. Even some of their textbooks are still in use. Do you remember whose textbook that was that they're still using?
Samuelson's book, I think, is in 19th edition. Yeah. And for sure we all used it in economics.
And they had something like 34 Nobel laureates came from the University of Chicago.
I think it was 30 in economics.
No, it's 87. I wrote this down. 87 total Nobel laureates from the university. 34 of 84 of Nobel laureates in economics.
Unreal.
Were from Chicago.
Unreal.
And 24 Pulitzer Prize winners.
Crazy.
Yeah, so Ben and I went up to the Nobel Laureates Hall up on the sixth floor yesterday to see all the pictures of who has been awarded. When you see them all in one spot, it is unreal. And you go through, you know so many of the names.
Barack Obama was there right above Fama.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
You know, Richard Thaler.
Thaler, yeah. It's kind of a digression from the story, but we should talk about just briefly Eugene Fama's comments about Thaler, which were pretty.
Oh, it was hilarious.
Pretty funny. He said.
I wrote that one down.
What do you remember what he said?
Yeah, he said.
Behavioral finance is a subset of the efficient market hypothesis.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
That's what Fama told Thaler, that until you have a model.
Yep.
I'm calling
you a branch. A branch of what
branch.
We do.
Exactly.
That's it.
So he said, I'm the main guy. That's pretty funny.
So the big takeaway that I got was really about technology and how, you know, when Eugene Fama arrived here in 1960, that's when they brought in their first supercomputers, you know, using the old punch cards, and they're actually able to start capturing data of stock returns, which did not exist.
They had the ability to do it, and then one of the professors at Chicago went to Merrill Lynch and said, you know, it might be good for your business if you had total market stock return data, because at the time all there was S&P 500. So Merrill Lynch said, sounds like a good idea. So they actually gave $200,000 as a grant to the university. And that's how the CRISP, the Center for Research and Security Prices, was born.
But the intersection, you know, and then to find out that it was Myron Scholes that was actually running the developing all the computer models and running the data for pharma.
Yeah.
Before, while he was just a student doing. Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
But do you think of how much data that is? All stock trading going back to the 20s.
Yeah.
For all NYSE stocks. Well, it's an unbelievable project.
And they said when they were collecting the data, they didn't have computers powerful enough to process it. So they were gathering the data, hoping that computing power would catch up so that they could actually do something with it.
And it was Gene Fama that was really pushing hard to get this data because he wanted to do analysis.
Mm-hmm. Crunch the numbers.
Crunch the numbers to see what they could learn.
And so up till then, they didn't have a way to do it. So that's right. The technology arrived. And
so he starts thinking about stuff like small cap. You couldn't even look at it before CRISP, because all you had was S&P 500.
Right.
So there's no way to say, okay, what's S&P 500 done versus what has total market done versus what has small cap done? Didn't exist. So in 1969, David Booth, who eventually founded Dimensional, came to Chicago to do his PhD. So he was studying under Fama. And
his first professor was Fama.
Yeah.
And I guess that changed his world from that point forward.
Yeah. They said that it shook his world. So as he was studying and doing research, and I think he became Fama's teaching assistant, but he eventually decided he actually didn't want to stay in academia. So he told Fama this, like, I'm not going to continue. And Fama said, okay, well, I'll connect you with somebody in industry. So he connected him with Mac McCone, who was at Wells Fargo at the time, I think.
Yes.
And then together they created the first index fund. So Booth and Mac McCone at Wells Fargo created the world's first index fund. And it was an equal-weighted total U.S. market, right?
For institutional investors, I believe, it was nothing retail yet. It was Jack Bogle, a couple years later, that created the first retail product, I believe.
And obviously what Jack Bogle did was amazing to release it to retail investors, but I thought it was fascinating because he gets all the credit for index funds. But the fact that Booth, who, you know, people look at Dimensional, I think in a lot of cases people think Dimensional is a relatively new company because they haven't heard of it maybe. But Booth, who founded it, was the first person to create an index fund.
Right.
I thought that was
back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So eventually Booth decides that he's going to create this small cap fund. And his reason at the time had nothing to do with higher expected returns because nobody knew that existed.
Correct. That research had not been done yet.
That's right. But Booth had seen from his work with institutional investors that people only had large cap exposure. That's right. So
because he was a consultant at the time, right?
That's right.
He moved on from Wells Fargo, became a consultant advising pension funds,
yeah,
and realized they were all investing largely in large cap stocks.
So he pitched, I think, to his employer at the time, or maybe it was to an institution. It must have been to his employer. Pitched a small cap fund, and they said no. So he was like, okay, I'm going to leave, and I'm going to go build it. And he did, and started pitching the product based on diversification, just telling institutions, listen, you're all large cap. I'm going to give you this product that gives you small cap exposure. And there was maybe some interest. And then Ralph Bonds, who was Eugene Fama's student at the time, came to Fama and said, hey, I'm noticing this thing where small cap stocks tend to be doing better than large cap stocks. And so Bonds' paper, that was the first time the small cap effect was identified. And obviously Fama and French built on that later, but Bonds was the first person to document it. So then that becomes part of Booth's pitch as he's building his new product. It's not just diversification. It's like, hey, we're actually noticing that small cap stocks in the data perform better than large cap stocks.
But he created the product just for diversification, not to get the small cap factor.
The small cap factor came later.
Right.
It was like, okay,
when you look at the story that they tell, there's a lot of catching up. The ideas originally were about diversification, but then as technology caught up, as the factors were being revealed, then there was more enlightenment.
Yeah.
But you think about that world. Like, we talk about factors, I think, every episode. Back then, there were no factors.
That's
it was just becoming known that it was very hard to beat the market, which was one of the propositions put forward by Fama, the efficient market hypothesis. That was just being developed at that point.
Well, that was Fama's dissertation. The birth of the EMH was his dissertation when he was studying at the university. And who was it that reviewed his dissertation? Was that Merton Miller?
I believe so.
I believe it was as well. But it was
Miller. It was Miller.
So Fama came to him with five ideas, and Miller was like, "Nah, this one's crap. This is crap. This is crap. Oh, this one might have some legs."
Yeah.
And that was the.
And that's when Fama was in Europe for a couple of years. He said, "I could have saved all this time. I wrote all these five papers, and if I'd only talked to Merton Miller first, he would have saved me a lot of time.
Or had I not gone to Belgium, I would have been further ahead in my career."
Well, that's one of the things they talked about. The culture at the University of Chicago is, I don't know, they didn't say it was cutthroat, but it sounds just ultra competitive and ultra direct.
Direct feedback.
Yeah, which is another interesting part. But that was Fama's comment, that if he'd been at Chicago, someone would have told him it was crap a long time ago, as opposed to spending any time on it. So in 1991... Ken French came to the University of Chicago. So obviously people know now the Fama French three-factor model, but it wasn't until 1991 that French came to the university. And the really interesting thing, as it ties into dimensional, is that Fama and French start doing their research. They start pulling together all of these other papers and finding, okay, there's the size effect and there's a value effect. They're plugging away doing the research before they've published anything. So this isn't common knowledge yet. They've talked to Booth about it, and Booth had actually launched a value product based on their research
prior
to them releasing anything. So that, to me, was like, wow. But you know, and I hate sounding like a dimensional promoter or groupie or whatever, but it's unbelievable that they are so tied into the research that before things are published, they're implementing it in
products. Because DFA at that point, dimensional, was 10 years old at that point, because they were founded in 1981.
That's right.
So this is long before factors were a thing.
Yeah.
They were doing the diversification story. And it was a fledgling fledgling company for much of that decade.
Yeah. I've heard David Booth speak at these conferences, and he's very humble. And he talks about being a student of Gene Fama, but he also talks about not continuing at the University of Chicago because he didn't have the marks. And Gene wouldn't, was sort of frowning at him. But I think that might be just David Booth's humility. And when he went on, he really is very humble about how the firm started. And the first 10 years, he said, were pretty lean. Like there were no factors. There was no evidence around what he was launching. And so he said it was a tough grind.
Well, he tells the story of the first 10 years, how he launched the small cap product. And then small caps underperformed for 10 years.
That's right.
For a decade.
Yeah.
It was lean.
Yeah. He does say that he still got buy-in because the institutions that were buying the product, they got that there was a reason to it. And at the time, there was data on small caps. So they were like, okay, we're bought into this strategy. So anyway, that was sort of the history of Chicago, of the University of Chicago, and dimensional, how those things tie in so closely together. But it's just amazing to think that dimensional... Yes, it's a fund company. Yes, they do sell products, but they've been tied in with modern finance since before modern finance was modern finance. Like all of these guys who sat on the board of Dimensional one day.
Crazy, like Merton Miller and Myron Scholes became directors because they needed directors.
It's crazy.
For the fund company. So they just went down the halls of the university and said, "Would you do it? Would you do it?" And those two, giants said yes.
I think they weren't giants at the time. That's the crazy part about it. But I think Brad mentioned yesterday that. I think it was Scholes. It was either Miller or Scholes. Told Booth, I don't think this is going to work because I think you're going to get killed in implementation costs. But it looks like a fun experiment, so yeah, I'm in. It's crazy, and that obviously Dimensional's gone on to prove that with the way that they implement products, they are able to capture the premiums after costs.
But going back to the icons that have come out of the University of Chicago, at the end of this sort of history. They went through Miller, Markowitz, Sharpe. Already we've talked about Scholes. It just is, it's pretty impressive. I mean, you can't help but
the most impressive thing about it is that these guys were part of Dimensional before they were who they are. It's not like Dimensional went found all these Nobel Prize winners and said, "Hey, do you want to join our company?" It's like they found the people with the best ideas at the time who ended up being Dimensional.
So really it becomes like a validation because all of these people were involved with Dimensional, David Booth, Gene Fama, before they became the juggernaut that they are today.
Right.
And they all were recognized for their work from the Nobel Institute afterwards.
Right.
So and even I've heard Gene Fama in past presentations say, you know, this information was coming. I just happened to be the right guy at the right spot at the right time with technology. These factors would have been discovered eventually.
Right. Yeah.
But to have it all happen with this group at this university.
Well, it's like an incubator. It's the intersection of economics and finance and
then the real world application with Dimensional.
So that was all really interesting. Now that was not Fama speaking about their history. They actually had an employee of Dimensional who was previously a history teacher who went to Stanford. The guy was a fantastic speaker. So he delivered that talk. But the talk after that was Eugene Fama being basically interviewed by Marlena Lee. What's Marlena's title at?
Marlena is co-head of research.
She's the co-head of research. So I had dinner with Marlena, and I'll talk about that with a group of people. I'll talk about that maybe as we go along. But Marlena, I was asking her questions that I wasn't trying to stump her, but I had a lot of burning questions just from research that I've read from other sort of quant companies like AQR and just other things that have come up over time. And every single question that I asked Marlena, she had just a unbelievably rock solid answer. Like, oh yeah, well, we looked at that 2 years ago and here's what we found. And I'm like blown away. Not just by the fact that they've already looked at it, but by the quality of the answers. And I couldn't name a paper that she wasn't familiar with. That was even crazy. Like I was listing off, I spend more time than I probably should reading academic papers, but every single one that I mentioned to Marlena, she had read the whole entire thing and had a response. It was impressive. Anyway, so in Fama's talk, he was actually talking about a paper that him and Ken French recently released. It was published in the Financial Analyst Journal. And I guess as a funny little aside, Fama said that they butchered his paper. The editors of the paper butchered
they
it.
Put it in past tense.
Yeah, they put it in past tense, which is apparently a great sin in Fama's eyes. So him and French re-released the paper on SSRN in the way that they had wanted it to be. That was kind of funny. But the paper is great. We read it as a firm when it came out, and hearing Fama explain it, I mean, it's this guy who won a Nobel Prize, just came out with a new paper that is very interesting, and hearing him walk through the paper in person, to me, it was amazing. And his ability to explain the concepts was unbelievable as well.
But that's one of the advantages of these conferences. Like, we're here in Chicago, and it's because you have access to these huge thinkers. These right. people are leaders in economics.
Right.
And you would never have this experience anywhere else.
Right.
And you could tell he wanted to get back to his desk to do work. As soon as he was done,
gone.
He was gone. Like, he was on a mission to get work done. He wasn't about to linger and...
Yeah. So the paper, which we can link in the show notes, it's called Volatility Lessons. And they built a model, a statistical model using the bootstrapping technique to create these massive data samples. So they basically took monthly returns going back to 1963 through 2016. And bootstrapping means that they took all those monthly returns and then they took 100,000 samples from that set of returns with replacement. So that means the way Gene described it is you take a bucket, dump all of the monthly returns from 1963 to 2016 in the bucket, take one out, that's your first monthly return in your data series, and then you put it back in. And then you take another one out, and so they did that 100,000 times for monthly, yearly, 5, 10, 30 year.
20 and 30 years, that's right.
Time mm-hmm. periods.
And it's about the premiums, right?
That's right.
The difference in the return of the equity markets over T-bills for the month.
Correct.
That was the first series they did.
Correct. So they looked at market. They looked at market value over market. They looked at big value over market, small value over market. So all of these different factor exposures. But because it becomes such a large data sample, you can look at how the distribution of outcomes changes as you progress to longer periods of time. So how does the data look over monthly periods? How does it look over annual periods? And the main observation, I think, is that over long periods of time, you end up getting more of a skew on the right. So you end up with more positive outcomes. as you go along through time. So over longer periods, you're more likely to get a positive outcome than a negative outcome. But somebody asked Gene during the talk or after the talk, does this mean that time diversification works? So does this mean that over a longer period of time, you're reducing your risk? And Gene did his Nobel laureate laugh. but he said that, well, your probability of a negative outcome over long periods of time decreases, the magnitude of those negative outcomes actually increases. So over a 30-year period, if you lose, you might lose a lot, even if that's less likely than winning. But that kind of becomes the story of the equity premium, where over longer periods of time, but the crazy thing was, even over a long period of time, you still had the equity premium, what was it, 4% or 5%?
4% at 30 years.
4%
of a negative return.
4% probability of a negative return.
Negative premium.
Negative premium.
Right, correct.
The return can be positive, is the difference between that equity and the 1 month T-bills.
And the T-bill, yeah. That's right.
But still, over 30 or 20 years, the equity premium can be negative. What is negative 7.8% of the time?
Yes.
He says, if it wasn't that way, there would be no premium.
That's right.
Because it is risk.
That's right. There has to be a delta.
That's exactly what he said. He said, if there were a 0% chance of a negative outcome, then the prices were wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then he talked about risk, which wasn't really statistical at all. He talked about risk of war, risk of having assets repossessed.
Yeah.
So that was so interesting. That's kind of real world practical.
That's right. He kept talking about, you know, let's talk about real world. There's, you know, statistical, and then there's real world. And I think the expression that he used was, we, you know, nominal and average returns, those are all great for our statistical models, but we eat real returns. So let's talk real returns. Yeah. And then he talked about currency, you know, wherever you live. And he did talk about that, Cameron, you know, about that the risk of war was not factored into the data. Because as you diversify across different countries and regions,
well, it's just the risk of expropriation. But I want to tie back to the thing that you were just mentioning, Brenda, on the average return versus the return.
Yeah, real return.
So when we're talking about the risk question that he laughed about, he said that the risk of the average return decreases, but the risk of the return increases. And you eat the return. And I was like, oh, wow. That's an interesting way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
Because in the 30th year, you could have a very serious negative return.
That's right.
You're not guaranteed safety
for
30 years.
There were lots of questions about, you know, in retirement, what does this mean? What does this mean for us to give advice to people planning for retirement? And one of the things that I did not ask was, you know, it's the order of the returns in retirement that will define whether you have a positive retirement experience or a negative retirement experience. So
he gave a lot of respect for owning fixed income.
That's right.
We get asked a lot, well, why would I own any bonds? Well, we have a whole generation of investors post 2008 that have never really seen volatility. So
that whole conversation was fascinating. But
one of the things he said, political risks are undiversifiable.
Yeah, he did talk about that was interesting.
And he talked about it also not even being quantified yet, political risk.
Right.
And he says, I don't think there's been anybody who's actually tried to quantify that risk.
Right.
And then he also talked about liabilities and public pension plans here. He says, what
the
difference basically, did you use the word criminal? But he said, you could never do this in private enterprise, not
go to jail.
Calculations.
I think he did use. I think he said criminal. I think if you did the type of accounting that public institutions do as a private entity, you would go to prison.
He says pension liabilities are 3 times larger than what are actually stated, which is a huge problem.
Yeah.
And that they're in their reporting. They use a very high discount rate.
Right.
Right.
Which is way overstated. So.
And I think one of the other really interesting things that he said on the topic of risk is that Marlena asked him about black swans. So his answer was that black swans do occur in monthly and annual returns, but they go away over long periods of time. So like majorly negative events, they don't tend to show up in the very long term, in the very long term data.
What did you think about his comments when someone asked him about the factor zoo and the fact that there are now over 400 different factors?
What did Gene say?
Well, he basically said they're all spinoffs of the main ones that they have found, which is profitability, value, and size.
Yeah. Yeah, I've read similar things in other literature. I think Larry Swedger's written about that too.
And you talked to Marlena about that last night, I think, right?
Well, so one of the things that I asked her about was the Campbell Harvey, who's another academic, who I'm not always a fan of what he writes, but he came out with a paper, I think it was this year, where he says that that to be a robust factor today, based on how many factors are coming out and how much research is being published, a t-stat of 2, which used to be sufficient to be statistically significant. Campbell Harvey wrote a whole paper, which I didn't read the whole thing, to be honest, but I read the abstract. He's basically saying that you need a t-stat of 3 in today's world because there are so many factors.
Wow.
So I asked Marlena about that, and she'd, of course, read the paper, and she kind of and she kind of laughed, and she said that that's only true if you're not doing robustness tests in other ways. So if you're just testing random stuff in the data that may not have a sensible explanation, then yeah, you might need a t-stat of 3. But if you're doing what Dimensional is doing in the way that they the way that they vet their research in ways more than statistical models, then you don't need the t-stat of 3. Because if you look at small cap, one of the things Campbell Harvey says is that small does not have a t-stat of 3. So therefore, he doesn't believe that it's a real premium. Now, AQR wrote about that, and I talked to Marlene about this too, but AQR wrote about the size premium. They agree that, yes, it's not statistically significant, but when you control for profitability and size, no, profitability and relative price in the small cap universe, then the T-step becomes very strong again. And Dimensional's been doing that for, of course, mm-hmm. years. It's the small cap growth anomaly, which is explained by profitability. But anyway, DFA is looking at all that stuff. So when you're not looking at all the other stuff, Marlena says, yeah, you might need a t-stat of 2. But why would you not be looking at the other stuff? If you're producing a factor that's not sensible and has a t-stat of 3, is that enough? Maybe not.
So I'm curious, Brenda. So you've been in the industry a long time, worked in large organizations, led many advisors over the years. What's your takeaway now that you've been in this environment for, I think you've been with us for over 10 years now.
Yeah.
How do you view, what this is about?
So interestingly, we talked about it before starting the podcast, was that Dimensional is a best kept secret, if you will, in the broader industry. And when I came to PWL and heard about Dimensional, that was really the first time. My takeaway is learning about everything that they do and seeing over more than a decade at PWL how they have actually evolved at Dimensional. Not only have they grown spectacularly, but they have evolved how they deliver their advice and their support to advisors. Their research is incredibly robust, and Ben just talked about that you have to look at factors, you have to look at any statistical element you're trying to examine. You have to look at it from so many perspectives. Looking at it through one lens is not sufficient. So they're super robust on all of this research. I can't say that, other firms are less robust or more robust than Dimensional, but certainly the way they expose it to advisors and are happy to show it and bring the people that actually do the research in front of the advisors, they've got nothing to hide. Nothing to hide. Like, put Gene Fama out there, get Ken French out there. They'll, we've been exposed to Bill Merton too. So, Robert Merton. So that's one thing. Their research is super robust. They've evolved over at least a decade, and maybe it was the global financial crisis. They've evolved their conferences and how they give their support and advice to advisors, from really technical investment advice, all about capital markets, the Fama French model, to that's still important, But now that most people have actually understood it and learned it and it's become a lot more mainstream, as you say, the proof of that is there's this proliferation of factors out there. Well, people have hitched their wagon to these factors and are inventing factors. But, you know, the core factors of the Fama-French model are the foundation of it all. So they've evolved it from technical investment research to more practice management and communications. Because one of the discussions we had last night was how Dimensional is really spectacular at communications. And they help advisors with the communications. It's not so much helping them explain the factor models. It's helping them continue to explain to regular investors why this is a robust model and how this is good for them. So that's one of the ways I've seen them evolve over 10 years.
And you've seen the MERs drop over the years as well, which they show.
Exactly. That's unusual, because usually, you know, every fund company is out there to continue to maximize their own profits. So you don't see that from other fund companies.
The big thing with Dimensional, like, yes, there are so many other factor products out there, but Dimensional has built this crazy moat of their ability to implement, which is probably the hardest part of factor strategies. One of the things that came up at dinner last night was Manulife's multi-factor ETFs that they've launched in Canada, which track an index that Dimensional's created. So Marlena had interesting comments about that too, which is basically that Dimensional gives them the index, but it's up to them how they implement. Like, they may not follow the index exactly. It's up to them when they trade, all that kind of stuff. And we've talked about this in the past on the podcast. We've run regressions on those multi-factor ETFs, and the factor tilts are non-existent, as far as I can tell in regression. At least not statistically significant. Yeah, anyway.
Anyways, we get to see Marlena today again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Should be interesting.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably it.
I think that's it. It's a great conference so far. And
yeah.
We'll be back on next week.
Highly valuable. Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
All right, that's it.